afternoon to our East Coast audience. Good morning to the rest of you, and thank you for joining us in today's audio conference series for aspiring women healthcare executives and for men on the journey to enlightenment who want to learn to be more successful healthcare leaders. I am Linda O'Brien, Office Manager at Healthcare Collaboration. We work with disgruntled doctors and hospital leaders to improve clinical and financial performance. Today's audio conference, entitled Changing Behavior, is our third and final audio conference this season. To all of our participants, if you have questions that you would like us to answer, please email them to us at info@healthcarecollaboration.com. What we do not have time to answer live today, we will reply to you by email within the next week. Our speaker today, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, has been a pioneer in the field of behavioral health, working with healthcare professionals and patients to change behaviors that lead to improved health. A nursing scholar, educator, and researcher, her pioneering work is the foundation for the newly published book entitled Changing Behavior: Immediately Transform Your Relationships with Easy-to-Learn Proven Communication Skills. Georgiana is the director of the National Institute of Whole Health. She blogs for Huffington Post, Dr. Mehmet Oz's Share Care, Daily Strength, Team Daily Strength, and Easy Health Options. Her expertise has been showcased in hundreds of print, online, radio, and TV interviews, including on Oprah.com, WebMD, CNN News, Self, and Shape magazines, to name a few. In addition, for 20 years until recently retiring, she hosted a nationally syndicated cable TV show, Woman to Woman, which explored all topics of interest to women with a special focus on relationships. Georgiana currently hosts the Changing Behavior radio program featured on the Healthy Living Network. Georgiana will share with us on the topic of changing behavior. But first, I'd like to introduce today's moderator who will be leading the call. Jamie Hauser is Vice President and Chief of Operations at Women's Hospital, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She teaches two ACHE seminars, Leadership Persuasion Skills, and Strategic Planning Network. Jamie will be the sole moderator of today's event in Dr. Kuhn's absence. Okay, now we'll turn it over to you, Jamie, and welcome Dr. Georgiana Donadio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you so much. I have to share with the audience how excited I am about this particular audio conference, because it's about, again, very, very simple things we can do to improve communications. The one skill I wish I'd done better my entire career is to listen, and we're going to be talking about that and some other things. So, Georgiana, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and looking forward very much to hearing what you have to tell us this morning.
Well, thank you, Jamie, and thank you, Linda, for that lovely introduction. Hello, everyone. I am very pleased and extremely privileged to be invited to speak with you today, and I'm excited about sharing with you the work and the information that we developed and researched up here in Boston at some of our hospitals here, as well as some other hospitals around the country, but particularly we did a lot of work over the years with various Harvard Medical School teaching hospitals. And so the research has been fun. We've done a lot of pilot studies with nurse cohorts and with educators. And the feedback has been so helpful, because we were able to, really assist in the transformation of the various hospital cultures. And that really turned out to be such a rewarding and satisfying experience, not just for us, the researchers, but for the hospital, the staff, the patients, the professionals, the doctors and the nurses. So it's with great enthusiasm that I bring this to you today. Now, I know you've got a set of PowerPoint slides in front of you, and I will make reference to them from time to time as we're talking. On the second slide, you'll see a cover of the book that this information is actually consolidated in. It's called Changing Behavior, as Linda described to you, and it has received a lot of very positive attention and awards and feedback. And in the third slide, we talk about basically the approach to the research we did, identifying that it's a challenge to be a human being and to have relationships. And it says we are often unaware of our unconscious agendas regarding ourselves and others. And this is probably one of the largest issues that we address in terms of changing our behavior, is that we need to look at and start at the very the beginning of all relationships for ourselves, and that is ourselves. And so it can be a challenge for each of us to be able to look at ourselves in an objective way, to take a step back and to take a look at how we are interacting, because every one of us brings to every interaction, to every relationship, we have beliefs, we have values, and we have a worldview. Now, those beliefs, values, and worldviews, those are the things that we've developed uniquely as human beings so that we can adapt and we can survive and we can learn to live in the world. So we're very married to those things. And in changing behavior, there's a lot of talk about the brain function and the neurology and the limbic system and all those great things that we need to understand to be able to wrap ourselves around why we will often resist hugely making any behavioral changes. And I'm sure all of you are aware in your own hospital culture, in your own executive culture, that there are many different issues that are behaviorally driven that you would like to address or that the culture would like to address. So hopefully this little orientation will do that. So we know that it is a challenge to be a human being, and we also know that relationships are, in fact, the number one area in all of our lives that we start to come into conflict with. Once we get past survival and safety, we have a roof over our head and food to eat and warmth and shelter and clothing. Our next imperative, the third level from Maslow's hierarchy, of course, is belonging or relationships. And in the introductory slide, which I believe is slide number 5, it talks about making sustainable lifestyle changes when we're looking at patients, when we're looking at executives, when we're looking at making permanent or sustainable changes. We know that most of us have a real problem with that longevity of change. The quick change, the short-term change, that's not usually an issue. Most of us can be motivated to make those changes for short-term. And according to BJ Fogg from Stanford University, there are three things that are required for change to begin or for change to be made. And one is the trigger. The other one is the ability within that environment to accomplish that change. And of course, motivation. And then according to the research that we have done, in order for there to be sustainable change as opposed to short-term change, which BJ Fogg is talking about, but for there to be sustainable change, what we have discovered in our research at the Institute is that there has to be an emotional shifting that allows the individual's beliefs, values, and worldview to integrate new information that says this is good, this is important, this is going to enhance or ensure my survival. So I am now motivated to make that change on a sustained level because I know that that is going to have a long-term effect on my life, my survival, my existence. So, of course, the big question becomes how do we engage people in this way? How can we, I mean, if we know how the mechanism works, we know that in politics, in changing behavior, we cite this study, how when you're talking politics with people, even if you present them with the most amazing, scientific, clearly defined facts about their political party or their candidate, people will dig their heels in deeper. They will resist even the most rational, logical, scientific approach to explaining the facts or the truth of a situation. And people will dig their heels in because if their beliefs, if their values, if their worldview is in any way not integrated with the information they're receiving, no matter how good that information is, the individual is going to see it as a threat to their survival. Because our survival, consciously, unconsciously, physically, on all levels, is based on how we develop neurologically, psychologically, environmentally, psychosocially, and so forth. So the research that we did was really looking at the big, big picture of what needs to occur for an individual to choose to make sustainable changes, either in their behavior towards their health, their behavior towards each other, or their behavior as a culture. So if we move on to the next slide, let's see, I just got to scroll down here. Okay, here we go. What are the first steps to making change? The questions are, how can we facilitate emotional shifting for sustainable behavior? And we now know what is required for sustainable change, but what steps are necessary for this to occur? So what has to happen during an educational exchange or an executive meeting, or what has to happen in any circumstance for this to occur? More questions. Can the way we communicate with another person assist them in triggering and connecting information that they need to integrate their motivation with their beliefs, values, and worldview? And how can we sustain? What would be the tools? What would be the steps? What would it look like for us to take a scientific basis to do this and to recreate this dependably over and over again? The next slide, which is page 7, talks about the 32 years of research and development, and you can read a bit about that if you'd like. And the next slide talks particularly about the studies that we did. We started in 1980. We were for 10 years at a state hospital working with recalcitrant patients. It was very challenging. And it was a quite wonderful outcome. Then for 5 years, we spent in a cardiac rehabilitation unit of one of the Harvard teaching hospitals, Union Hospital here in the Boston area. And both of those studies were just really gratifying, because the kind of information, the kind of feedback we got when the investigators and the researchers, when we talked to patients and we did our exit interviews and what have you, The summary of what they all said was, never before in my life have I been listened to like this. This was the overwhelming experience of the people that were the control groups within the pilots. And then if we go to page 10, it says, another important factor in the pilot studies was information and self-discernment. What we discovered, one of the critical keys towards making that sustainable shift, was that individuals, and we're talking first about the patients, then we talk about the staff members, because what we found is that the culture had a kind of a lineage of change. It started with patients and providers. It went from provider to provider. Then it went to the staff as an overall culture. And what the trial participants said, these are the patients, it's one thing to be told what to do and a whole other thing to understand how and why I get sick and then figure out what I'm willing to do about fixing it. It gives me back control and makes me more willing to make the changes I know I need to. So the idea behind the model that we constructed was for people to be given information that invited them into discernment of what they were willing to participate in. And that's what we found was the most successful technique or the most successful strategy for getting sustainable change. There were four
Georgiana,
critical...
Georgiana, This is Jamie. Let me pause you for just a second. I think that this is such great information, and I have to tell you that, you know, we've had personal experiences with it here at the hospital. I just want to take a minute and kind of link this work with the patients to how you deal with employees, for example. You know, increasingly we're talking about employee engagement, and I think this is what you're really talking about. You have to have the organization's vision, mission, and values aligned with those of employees, but beyond that, you know, I think what I've been thinking a lot about since reading your book is the degree to which Women's Hospital has been successful because we give people a voice in the decisions that affect them. For example, in our new hospital, it was our nursing staff that designed our patient rooms, not a bunch of architects. So, you know, this is such great information, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to link it to, like, everyday healthcare management, too.
Oh, I'm so glad you did. I think that that's so relevant to what we're talking about. And please, Jamie, jump in. You know, I'm very passionate about this. I've dedicated more than almost half my life to doing this work. Actually, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I'm 66 years old. So it's more than half my life at this point, and I'm very, very passionate about it. So please stop me at any time. Thank you so much.
I will. Thank you.
I want to talk about the four critical questions that patients have, but you can take these same four critical questions and you can apply it to any industry. And this is research out of the University of Washington, and it's absolutely brilliant stuff. Our whole curriculum, the National Institute of Whole Health runs a continuing education professional development curriculum where we take doctors, nurses, social workers, dietitians, health educators, and health professionals, and we re-educate them on the whole person sciences. Rather than learning things through systems and through symptoms, we teach from a whole person integrated model, and then we teach this behavioral model. So the four questions, and you can apply this to anybody, you just change the words around a little bit, but for patients, here we go. Are you really listening to me? Are you listening to me? Or are you thinking about your golf game this afternoon? Or are you worried about what you're going to cook for dinner? Is your mind somewhere else? Or are you listening to me? The very first line in the book, Changing Behavior, states, everyone wants to be valued. There is no greater way of showing respect to another person than to give them your pure presence, your real attention, your connection, your respectful listening, your looking, your being, your interacting with them. This is a huge piece. I've been in medicine, oh my goodness, for 50 years when I first started in nursing many, many decades ago. And I'll tell you, I think that we used to listen a lot better than we do now. What's happening today is that, and this was a study from Harvard that's in Changing Behavior, 50% of the time, 90% of us are not paying attention. That is huge. That means 90% of us, half the time, we're not paying attention to the people in front of us. We're not paying attention to what we're doing. And that's why we've got people saying that they feel so, you know, so distracted and so disconnected all the time. Question number two, can you tell me how this happened to me? What does that mean? We all want to know, how did this happen? There are many deep psychological and psycho-spiritual reasons for that I won't go into. But people want to know, what did I do? Because I want to know what I can undo. I want to know how this happened to me. Now, having been through many programs, many degrees, and what have you, I think I can safely say with a reasonable, a credible comment that the way we're educated in this country, we are not educated in an integrative cause and effect way. We're educated in a way that leaves so many questions. Like you pick up the PDR, and almost every drug in the book says, we don't know the known action. We don't know how this drug works, okay? People don't want to hear that. What they want to hear is that you have chronic disease because on a physical, on a nutritional, on an emotional, on an environmental, and even a values or a spiritual level, there are things that are out of balance in your life. People want to be educated. They want to understand, what can I do? So when they ask their practitioner, when the people on the executive board are trying to identify a problem in your administrative culture, they want to know, how did this happen? How did we get to have, you know, a 25% attrition rate? They don't want to know, it's the economy. They want to hear the cause and effect within the environment, within the culture. What can we do to make changes so that we can address this? And we'll hear about that a little further along. The third thing is, do you care what I know about my health, or do you care what I think caused this problem? Do you want to hear my wisdom? Do you want to hear my experience of living in my body? Do you want to hear my experience as an administrator on the executive team of the hospital? Do you care what I know, or do you just want to tell me what you know? And this is a huge problem in the healthcare delivery system in the United States today. And we know this because compliance is the number one problem in healthcare today. People do not want to be told what to do. They want to be invited into the dance. They want to be invited into the process. As well as people on an executive team, they want to be invited into that process as well. As Jamie so beautifully pointed out, why her hospital is as successful as it is, because everyone is respected and valued and invited. The last question speaks to some of the other things we've just talked about. Doctor or nurse practitioner or whoever, can you tell me how I can control this situation, this condition? The question is not, can you cure me? Can you fix me? Can you make me better? Can you take this away? The question is, can you tell me how I, who live in my body 24/7, how I can control this problem? People are not so much concerned about fixing everything as they are getting rid of the fear and getting rid of the pain and getting rid of the symptom. And they know, if they're explained how to do that, that they will be willing within their own mind and their own life. People are generally willing, if given control, to take that control to make themselves comfortable. And we do know that from the studies. And if you're talking on an executive team level, the question is very straightforward. You know, can you tell me how we can fix the problem? Tell me what it is. You know, can we start to do incentives? Can we start to, give people, you know, bonuses? What can we do to give people in our executive culture more control and more incentive to make these positive changes? The next slide, which is page 11, says creating better communication, okay? And below that, just in case you're interested, we did put a list of the other pilots. They are all referred to in the book, Changing Behavior. If you wanted to read them or see them in detail, you could do that. And some of the other results on page 13 that came as a result of these pilots was the model application reduced workplace attrition. People liked their jobs better. They felt more valued. The model increased work satisfaction. We use a work satisfaction tool in all of our pilots, and the work satisfaction was absolutely improved after the application of this model. The model reduces error-prone stress, and this is of particular concern because we do know that error is another major concern, along with lack of compliance. And usually error-prone situations are really situations where there's a lot of tension or stress or conflict. This model also enhances the morale, and it enhances peer-to-peer relationships. It reduces the cost of replacing employees, which we know attrition is very expensive. The model increases the staff's sense of well-being. They feel less that their job is in jeopardy, that they're being criticized or being looked at or being monitored or being worked to death less so than possibly before. We've been in hospitals that were wonderful, and we've been in hospitals that were not so wonderful, and it really does vary. There's an old Sicilian expression, the fish rots from the head down. So that basically means is that whoever's in charge of the hospital, you know, sets their own tone, and it does vary. The model, of course, enhances collaboration. And more importantly, and I like what Jamie said, because this is really to this point, it increases self-directed problem solving. So if a staff of a is the nurse or the hospital group, let's say you've got the nursing department or you've got the anesthesiology or something, and they're deciding that they're very unhappy or that they're not, you know, comfortable with certain things that are going on, this is a tool that changes the culture, which makes it safe and comfortable and an invitation for people to self-direct and do the problem solving within their department, and then to bring that to the people, you know, who need to sign off on that. And we feel that that is a very important aspect. Jamie, did you want to comment on that? Because you've obviously done that so well.
Oh, well, I totally agree. I mean, I'm happy to report that my hospital has been among Modern Healthcare's top 100 places to work for the last 5 years, and it has a lot to do with this. I think that the model that you're about to describe, you know, the notion of peer presence for me is just so important because, you know, I know that that people, when they feel valued, they feel that, you know, everyone wants to have meaning in their lives. And sometimes that meaning needs to be expressed by the leaders that, you know, that we really trust to shape the vision for where the organization is going, and people want to feel that they are engaged in that process. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about peer presence as you move along.
Wonderful. The next slide, and thank you for sharing that. I like this cartoon. It's the 12 steps of behavioral engagement with peer presence. We say it's heart-centered, it's not head-centered. And that cartoon basically sums it up in a very lovely way. And the question is, what is pure presence? Well, if we look at the definition of pure, and I love the second one, free from harshness, clean or without blemish, no appreciable alteration, meaning it is in a very clear, pure, unmuddled state. And what is presence? It's the fact or condition of being present, being with another person. And, you know, we all know this. I mean, we're all sophisticated grown-ups in the sense that we've been around the block a few times socially, and we've been to dinner parties, and we've been to all kinds of things. And what we know is when you're standing there talking to a colleague, and they're looking over your head to see who's coming in the door, or they're checking their watch because they, you know, are trying to make an exit. We know what it feels like when somebody is not purely present to us. And we know what it feels like when somebody looks at us in our eyes and expresses through their face, oh, great, tell me about that. I really want to hear about that. That's fascinating. So we do know what pure presence is. Now let's see if we can talk about the 12 steps that can lead anyone who follows these steps into creating this kind of wonderful communication presence. Well, the first thing that we want to know about pure presence is that we enter any communication with an understanding of what our intention is regarding that exchange. And we're really manifesting intention when we enter, you know, a communication being clear what our intent is. For instance, if we want to resolve or facilitate a conflict or a disagreement, if we want to achieve a goal, if we, you know, whatever we want to do. Sometimes we just want to be right. Sometimes we want to win. Sometimes we want to let off steam. We all have intentions, and those intentions are what often get in the way or positively create really good communication. So it's important that people be that their attention is brought to their to their intentionality and what they're bringing into a communication. One of the things that is not on here, but I just want to address for a brief moment, mutuality. Mutuality is when we walk into a communication and we understand as a human being that mutuality and shared values or shared perspective or shared agreement, these are things that create positive change. And if we have an intention of creating that kind of mutuality, that is going to be highly successful. And if we lose our focus or if we change our intention as part of the process of the conversation, then it is less successful. Step one, being, which is page 17, being physically comfortable. This is an important step that removes physical discomfort as a distraction. If sitting or standing, being centered, calm, and focused on the person you're speaking with communicates that you are listening and fully present to that person. So being physically comfortable is important. If you're sitting there and you're not comfortable and you're not able to relax into your physical body, that is going to be distracting and it will remove some of the success of your communication. Number two, of course, is naming your intention. Knowing what you want from that discussion or conversation. Giving complete attention to your intention is very important because you don't want to be wandering. If the mind chatter or your negative thoughts begin to occur, there are ways of refocusing on the conversation. And that is critical because when we're distracted in a communication, other people know it. There isn't anything that you're thinking or feeling that that other person can't discern. And we know this because of the relationship between the limbic system brain and all the subtle facial muscles, changes that take place that we'll talk about later. We know that everything we're thinking and everything we're feeling and everything we're projecting, that person is able to know. Step three is centered body posture. If we're crossing our arms and our legs, if we're not presenting open body language, then that, of course, is an obstacle. We don't play with our watch, our glasses, our hair. We don't repeatedly look away from the other person that we're speaking with because this sends a message that we're not listening and that we don't value the exchange or we don't value that other person. Step four, this is really a critical piece of the research. This was fascinating to do and one of my personal favorite parts of it. Step four has to do with sustained soft eye contact. It has been very scientifically proven, and in the book, Changing Behavior, all of the research and all the references are there, that when we sustain soft eye contact, non-judgmental soft eye contact with another person, that this eye contact stimulates oxytocin, which is the love and the trust hormone, and that opens up the emotional centers of the brain. And this assists in that important thing that we talked about in the integration of information and emotional shifting. So it's very, very important. It's very, very important that we realize what goes on with sustained eye contact. Step five, respectful inquiry. Many of you are familiar with this. This is about asking rather than telling or directing. It promotes another person's sense of value and safety and allows them to feel an expansiveness of the dialogue. Step six is the responsiveness without interrupting. Interrupting has got to be, I'm sure you know, I'm sure you're aware of it, I think we all are, that interrupting has become almost a kind of a sport in our culture. How quickly can I say what I want to say? How quickly can I get my opinion across? How quickly can I get what I'm sitting here thinking about, not listening? How quickly can I communicate my thoughts because my thoughts are important? So interrupting is a really important issue that needs to be addressed in most of our cultures, whether they're work cultures, family cultures, or personal relationship cultures. And that doesn't mean that we're not responding. It doesn't mean we're not listening. It means we're just not interrupting. Step seven is allowing for there to be silence and silent passages between what a person is saying and what we're taking in and what we're saying and what they're taking in. A lot of times we'll be having a conversation and we'll finish our thought and the other person will look at us and maybe nod their head, and we can get really nervous if they do that for a few seconds. We're wondering, oh my God, what are they thinking? Are they judging me? Did I sound stupid? Or sometimes when we simply sustain soft eye contact and we respond appropriately with our facial expressions and nodding our head and shaking, that gives us time to anchor our thoughts and to integrate our alpha brain and our beta brain. We're going to talk about in a little bit on the next slide. So if we look at the next slide, the key to sustainable behavior change is the occurrence of brain overlap, which results in emotional shifting. Did you want to interject on that, Jamie? I know we had talked about that prior.
Absolutely. I mean, I think at this point, it's especially important to note that, you know, this is stuff that people need to think about and actually practice in advance of an interaction. You know, especially the body language. I mean, I remember the old slide I've used for years about the degree to which people only listen to, I think it's 7% of the meaning of something is conducted, is conveyed actually through words, and body language is so much more revealing to other people. The other thing to think about, I think, in these kind of crucial conversations that we're talking about having, which is an excellent book, by the way, is to really think about the degree to which we all use this time of listening to also be assessing the other person's emotional state. So that, you know, we do it subconsciously, but so it gives you an opportunity to really assess whether or not the other person is really listening to you. To move forward in a way that maximizes the actual communication. I mean, communication doesn't happen until the other person understands the intent of the speaker. So I think that's a critical element. So I do practice in front of the bathroom mirror, you know, if I'm going to be having these kind of conversations, especially with the body language stuff.
Yeah. So wonderful. Thank you so much for affirming that. We don't have a lot of time, but I just want to quickly discuss brain overlap in case you're wondering what it is. We're functioning right now on a beta level, which means that, you know, we're thinking, we're talking, we're listening, we're responding, and that is our beta. That's a very rapid brain wave. And the brain wave that is below that is called alpha. And alpha is slower, and it takes place in a different part of our brain. What's the big difference? Well, the alpha brain is more of images and visual and unconscious, and the beta is certainly very conscious. Now, we've all had the experience of getting in a car. We know that we're going to work, and we're very busy thinking about the meeting, and we're visualizing that meeting and what's going to go on and all the things we have to discuss. We get to the office. We don't even remember getting there. And we go, wow, how did that happen? Well, that happened because our brain was in overlap. We were functioning on a beta level. We didn't run through the red light. We didn't crash into anything. We got to where we were going very safely. But our alpha brain was also engaged. And what was going on is that we were integrating information. We were integrating the cognitive information with the visual and some of the unconscious information. When that takes place, we call that brain overlap, and that's where the emotional integration and the values and the beliefs and the worldview is integrated to create this shifting. We call it emotional shifting because unless our emotions shift, we cannot change our behavior because our emotions are survival adaptations. So the whole idea is that we have to get to yes, and we get to yes through integrating the brain overlap and those two bodies of knowledge. And the next slide, we go to step 8, which is non-judgment. Boy, this is a challenge. We have to stop all unspoken mental and emotional judgment that would be immediately communicated. We may not think so, but judgment, we can smell judgment. Why? Because there's a body chemistry to thought. We can see it in the slightest change in the eye muscles, the facial expression, the body language. We know when we're being judged. So if we're sitting there judging and we're sitting there, making some kind of a a plan in our mind of counter responding to this person's thoughts or judging this person's comment or recommendation, that will be immediately picked up. Step number 9, eliminating the one up, one down in relational communication. Whether you're talking about marriage, whether you're talking about the office, whether you're talking about patient, doctor, nurse, whatever, what we're talking about is if one person takes on the role as the expert, takes on the role as the one up, more powerful, more in control, has more value than the other, this is an instant, especially today. Today is a very different world than it was 20 years ago. People will not accept or allow that kind of one up, one down relationship the way maybe 20, 25 years ago. And when I first started in nursing, when you were in the presence of a doctor walked in the room, you stood up. You did not sit down. And some of the nurses even did a little curtsy if they were older nurses at the time back in the 60s. And the nurses, the doctors were almost always men, and there was this tremendous chasm between the doctor and everyone else at the facility. And that has changed, happily. But this is the kind of mentality that we have to root out, this kind of non-team playing attitude. So we need to be team players, and we need to express that.
You know, Georgiana, let me pause you for a second here because, I want to relate this to something that we found to be very important in patient safety, and that's the cockpit resource management stuff, the CRM, where, the people, any member of a team needs to be prepared to step in, for example, and interrupt some practice that's not safe. So as opposed to having, the co-pilot sort of reluctant to tell the pilot that there's ice on the wings, we nurses need to be prepared, and all of us in healthcare need to be prepared to stop things. And I think this is a really good illustration of that.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Then we have something called in-the-moment centering. And this is really quite important because what happens is we get off center. We get knocked off center. We lose our focus. Sometimes a thought comes in our mind or, a noise or something will distract us. There are simple techniques to be in the moment and to remain in the moment in spite of distractions. And then step 11 and 12, the step 11 is intentional collaboration, which is also mutuality. We take the attitude of intention and mindful presence with integrity versus manipulation or goal setting. And there is no interruption during the conversation. And that is so very important. You can interrupt people if it's absolutely necessary, and you can say, excuse me, we need to stop here, or excuse me, I feel that it would be of value to clarify that or whatever. But we can't not value what the person is saying. And step 12, of course, is called the sacredness of relationships. That's holding another person's communication as worthy of reverence, clear boundary awareness, and others' inherent value. And these 12 steps have been, clinically proven to create this environment for emotional shifting. By consciously using these receptivity steps, which allow for personal worldview, values, and beliefs to shift, and receptivity steps equals the crux of rapport, which is about shared agreement and the meeting of the minds. So that is what this is about. It's about transforming organizational cultures, transforming individual cultures, and we do offer very short video streamed and telephone based workshops in this for organizations. And we know from the information and the feedback that we've gotten that this is probably one of the easiest fixes and most profound changes that we can make in our culture, is to get everyone on a pure presence, respectful, mindful, listening wavelength to connect the culture, and it just changes so many things in such a positive way.
Georgiana, let me ask you to go back for a second to step 10.
Okay.
In the moment recentering, can you give examples of some of the simple techniques that you have in mind here?
Okay. Let me just get back to that slide. Yes, in other words, let's say you're distracted. you know, you're sitting there and, I mean, look, let's be real. Sometimes we're listening to people and they have a monotone. And they're putting you to sleep. Maybe you just don't particularly resonate with the sound of that person or what that person has to say. I'll share a little trick with you, and this is, all goes back to the recentering. Number one, if you are the person doing the presentation, research shows that if you speak faster than 210 words a minute, you do not lose the attention of your audience. When I'm talking, when I'm teaching at the university or at the hospital or whatever, I speak much faster than when I'm talking in conversation. Why? Because if I'm speaking at a certain rate of speed, you will not have time in between my words to become distracted. What happens with many speakers is that they speak slower. They don't speak at that rate. And what happens is where there is a gap, your brain is so creative, our brain is so creative, that it's going to fill it up. It's kind of like, you know, one of the laws of physics. So the point is when that starts to come into your brain and you understand, and we teach all of this, when you understand why it's happening, what you do is you identify before that a word that puts you back on track, okay? I use the word focus or attention. And I sit in on a lot of lectures and teleconferences just like you do, and sometimes I'm fully present and sometimes I work at being fully present. So it's a matter of having skills, and we have many skills and many techniques that we can share and teach people to use during these things, and one of them is the rate of speed. And some cultures, after they take this workshop, they will say to people, I want you to be aware that when you're presenting on Thursday, I want you to speak with a certain kind of fluidity and speed, okay? And this way we'll keep the audience. And that is a wonderful, not very well-known fact, by the way, and I hope you find it of value.
Thank you.
Okay.
So where are we now, Jordana?
Where are we? I'm done.
Okay.
I'm done. I've presented the steps. I've let everyone know that, in fact, they can read about the studies in changing behavior. They can read about the steps more in depth about that if they'd like to. They can download the first chapter of the book for free by going to changingbehavior.org. They can read it if they like it. They can read what the clinical administrator and director of the Leahy of the Mayo Clinic had to say about this model. They can, you know, really explore that for free by downloading that chapter. And if they want more information, they can get it on a Kindle for free. If they're a Kindle Prime member, they can purchase it for under $4. So it's a good resource to have.
Excellent. Well, I think what I'm discerning here also is, as I go over the steps, it's more and more revealing. I think that what I'm discerning here is a lot of the stuff that is also covered by Goldman and others in the whole notion of emotional intelligence. Because when I teach, for example, my persuasion class, one of the steps in effective persuasion is to connect emotionally with your audience. So I think it's that same kind of alignment that really creates such a degree of connection that makes this model so effective.
Right, and I think connecting with your audience, quite frankly, is understanding. I mean, you know, forgive me, but I tend to be scientifically oriented. I think it's good to understand that we need to connect with our audience, but how do we do that? You know, it's like, okay, how can I do that? I think that we're used to having steps, we're used to having process, we're used to having proven skills, and I think the beauty of this, this has been identified as the first ever guide that is, you know, kind of research-based on how to go step by step, how to create that kind of connection and that kind of emotional intelligence. We can, I know Golden's work is wonderful out of Harvard, and, you know, he, you know, basically talks about how some people have emotional intelligence and other people don't. Well, how do we create the steps to develop that, and how can we do that as a culture? And I think you're right. I think that a lot of this is about, again, the word emotional, because emotional is what drives all of us. We're all emotional creatures because those are our survival techniques.
You know, I think what is useful also is to understand the difference between this kind of technique and where you're actually trying. I think it's very connected to persuasion, where you're engaging somebody and being interested in making change happen and making change less fearful for people. And I think that one of the things I want to point out with the connecting emotionally element is that it's not at all emotional manipulation. It's not at all anything but being straightforward and being able to demonstrate to your audience your own emotional commitment to the change that you're proposing. So I think that's really important to discern that difference, in my view.
I agree with you, Jamie, because this has nothing to do with persuasion. Never in the steps have we mentioned getting agreement, getting people to agree with
right.
what you want. This isn't about that. This is about creating a level playing field in a way that invites and elicits people's cooperative change out of their discernment, out of their own integration of information. So what we do know is that persuasion can be good to a point, but in the final analysis, I'm just speaking for myself personally, I do not like to think about persuasion. Because if I'm persuading you, then when are you going to wake up and figure out maybe you have a thought about that you don't agree with? You know, it's like, when is the mask going to come off? And maybe I've persuaded 20,000 people to buy something, and then they buy it and say, you know, I really didn't need this. So I think the idea behind persuasion, maybe we need a new word for it, you know, maybe we need to change that word, because it does kind of ring, it does have a ring of manipulation to it.
Well, I will, as the person who teaches it for the American College, I'll disagree with you a little bit, but I understand what your point is. I think that when we're talking about leadership, that persuasion is an effective tool to be used there, but I wanted to distinguish it from the kind of hard salesmanship that I think that you're talking about. But let's get back to your model for just a second. What are you working on now, Georgiana?
Oh, well, we are right now we're working with Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School Spalding Rehab System. Spalding has 6 different hospitals here in the Massachusetts area, and we are doing a systems-wide pilot with a nurse cohort and continuing to refine things. We're always refining things. We have a workbook now for the training. We have the training, and our idea is to bring this out. We're providing this training for a lot of different organizations that want their culture to be exposed to this. And because it's easy, it's simple, it's proven, it's inexpensive, we're really focusing on bringing this to the cultures to help transform. I mean, for 35 years, our mission statement has been to assist in the transformation of the practice of healthcare and medicine in all settings. So our commitment is to do that. And never before, I think never before has it been this bad in terms of the overall system. It was, you know, there were always pockets of things that weren't good in the system. But now we're seeing it kind of, system-wide. There are a lot of anxiety, a lot of unhappiness. Happiness, as you well know. Well, maybe not at your hospital, but in general, there's a lot going on.
No, I think there is. I think that we're finding ways, though, as we approach healthcare reform and the need to bend the cost curve and those kinds of things, that that the level of anxiety, I think, across the board is going up. But I will tell you that I'm seeing some real breakthrough stuff happening in physician relationships as well, because I think we've got. Because people are using tools such as yours to really approach how to make positive change happen and how to engage people in those changes. So, Linda, let me ask if we've had any questions come across on email.
No, actually, I haven't had any questions.
Okay. Well, thank you. Georgiana, any final words?
I'm sorry?
Any final words from you?
Oh, any final words? I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said. My final words is this. I think that today we're in a very exciting and challenging period in the history of healthcare in America. We are both heading into uncharted waters that hopefully will turn out to be smooth sailing once we get out of the harbor, so to speak. And on the other hand, we have some real problems that need to be addressed and addressed effectively. In the past, we've had everything from managed care to behavior, all kinds of behavior models, and we're really always searching for an answer to solve the problem. I think what we need to do is realize that people want to be respected, they want to be valued, they want to be engaged in the process, whether they're a patient, a staff member, or an executive, that we have to really create a more level playing field. And that is the way that we will effectively heal and transform our American healthcare and medical system today.
Well, Georgiana, I want to thank you so much for taking this time. This is Jamie Hauser with Dr. Georgiana Donadio from Boston. I know that I'm looking forward very much to putting some of your principles to work for me here at my hospital and engaging it also in some of my other teaching activities. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody for having joined us today. I want to thank Linda O'Brien for being facilitating our phone call and our recording of this audio conference. And this is, as she mentioned, our final conference. So I want to thank all of the men and women who have joined us for this series. And just want to say thank you to Ken Cohen for having engaged me in participating in this. So with that, we'll be signing off. And thank you very much, and hope this has been valuable for you.
So thank
Linda,
you
thank you very much.
Me. And thank you again
Georgiana,
for having me.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, my